Donald Dunn.
May it please the court, Mr. Don Frager will present argument for petition.
May it please the court, this is yet another default judgment case. The reason I say another, since this appeal was perfected in the Court of Appeals, I've had an opportunity to somewhat briefly run the index in the reporter system, and in that past 14 months or whatever it is, there have been 134 reported default judgment cases. Now, I don't know how many of those cases were service cases, or a denial of service, or inadequate service, or inadequate return, or the type of default judgment cases. But it is clearly, whatever the summary judgment type of cases in the appellate courts a few years ago, unquestionably, the default judgment cases are the most numerous now in the appellate system. I'm well aware that this court heard on March 1 the Higginbotham case. The Higginbotham case's first three points of error are very similar to my points of error. This court has, however, granted the writ on, in this case, on a different matter, namely the harmless error question and the effect of a less than adequate motion for service under 106, Rule 106, with an order that was followed implicitly. Now, in this case, in the motion for new trial hearing, the court, by agreement of the parties, accepted all the depositions as evidence in addition to the live testimony. And on page 10 of the statement of facts is that stipulation that the depositions with all exhibits attached would be made part of the record. The reason I raise that point is this court has an appendix of exhibits where I have, it's been filed with the Court of Appeals and brought forth with the record up here. And in that appendix, I have collected all the documentary exhibits from the depositions for convenience. They're all in the depositions. In fact, every instrument in this case, including the attachments at the back of our application for writ of error, are in the record, and as opposed to just attachments. The facts in this case are best set forth in the trial court's findings of fact and conclusions of law, which are in the appendix and also in the transcript. Judge Crowley very, very carefully, and I might add on his own motion, set forth the facts, and I can't particularly improve on that. This case is interesting, perhaps amusing. Jesse Wilson was injured in an automobile accident on March 1985. The court will find various letters between Mr. Wilson's attorney and the adjuster, a claims representative for National County Mutual Insurance, before suit was filed. Then Mr. Greenspan filed suit in the District Court, Tarrant County. Service was attempted on several occasions and failed because the defendant, Mr. Dunn, simply wasn't home. He lived in the same location for 6 years, but he works erratic hours. That's, of course, in the record, too. Finally, Mr. Greenspan approaches Judge White with a motion for service under Rule 106. The motion requested that Mr. Dunn be served by, one, having a copy of the petition, citation of the petition attached under the door, or two, serving the defendant's apartment manager. Now, it brings to mind one thing. When I speak of notice, you know, there are multiple kinds of notices, and I've seen some cases where no notice was called notice. When I speak of notice, I mean citation with petition attached, as opposed to your more esoteric types of notice. Okay, he signs the order, Judge White does, setting out precisely the wording in the motion for service. And pursuant to that order, the constable in Dallas County, and the defendant lives in Dallas County, served the apartment manager of Michael Dunn and made return that says, I have served Carol Bellinger, I think he used the word agent for service, for Michael Dunn at such and such an address.
Is it true that he did not refer to the 106 order in the return of citation?
He did not refer to the 106 order, yes, sir. No reference at all in the return. And after service, there was a letter from the adjuster. And incidentally, in the record, I'm perhaps getting ahead of myself, Mr. Greenspan kept getting phone calls and letters from National County's representative, from their adjuster, saying, we can't get Mr. Dunn's cooperation. And Mr. Greenspan went over to Mr. Dunn's house and nailed a copy of a letter to the door saying, you're not cooperating, and this is in the record, and I'll come back to this in a moment, you're not cooperating with your insurance company, and you're going to end up without insurance. And what's going to happen is I'm going to get your license under the Safety Responsibility Act, and just real bad things are going to happen. It's a beautifully nasty letter, gentlemen. And pursuant to that, Mr. Dunn contacts Mr. Greenspan either the next day or 2 days later and said, hey, I'm cooperating. They sent an adjuster out to see me. I received those papers from my apartment manager, and I gave them to my insurance agent, Violet Perez. And then they sent an adjuster, they mean his insurance company, sent an adjuster out, and I gave him a statement in December 1986. And I told him that I took these papers and gave them to my insurance agent. Then he gets a letter back saying, we're apparently served. I'm not going to say that. The respondent says apparent. The letter says, we have now been served. We need to try to settle this, so we want you to enter into a written agreement, not take default, to give us 10 days written notice. Now, I believe that was just before this.
Was that agreement observed?
Sir?
Was that agreement observed?
Yes, sir. With one kicker. Mr. Greenspan, because he was supposed to be out of town, had the hearing 9 days later, but the order wasn't signed until 18 days later. And I think Judge Crowley goes into that and finds a fact. Now, this court has essentially asked that we go into three matters. The first one, I might add, and I left out probably the main thing, it turns out, and this is well brought out by the Court of Appeals, that the motion for service under Rule 106 was not verified. Now, the Court of Appeals, let me back off. In the hearing on motion for new trial, there was the only thing that respondent brought up was that return was faulty because it used the word, quote, agent. Agent. And, but then, this is the motion for new trial here. For the first time on appeal, and they dropped this agent business, and on appeal, they said it is fatally defective because the motion for service under 106 was not verified. Therefore, everything that happened after that is meaningless. And the court, reluctantly, that's the words Judge Fender uses, reversed Rena's here. Now,
if Mr. Dunn had not received actual notice, he had not actually received, or there wasn't any evidence in this record that he had actually received the citation, would the other procedures used here be sufficient to support a default judgment?
Well, I think so. I think that had he not ever received the citation with petition attached, that subject to some other, maybe going directly to the insurance company or acceptance of service, surely I think that the court wouldn't have jurisdiction.
Would not have?
If Mr. Dunn was never served with citation and petition of tax, directly or indirectly, Judge, no, the court would not have jurisdiction.
If you had a motion, just like this motion, you granted, had an order, you took the citation and you delivered it to the apartment manager, and the return said serve on the lady's name, comma, agent, but there was no evidence whether Mr. Dunn actually received it or not, would that service be sufficient for default judgment?
Probably not, Judge. And that's the reason we are where we are now. Judge White, and that brings us to the little yellow stick-em tab, which I think is what brings us really here today. Judge White's procedure, and I might add most of the judges in Tarrant County, when they sign an order for service under Rule 106, before default judgment's granted, they want some evidence that the defendant actually got notice, particularly when you have service such as serving an apartment manager. That is, I think, a proper procedure. And Judge White, and it's in the record, in the presence of Mr. Greenspan, phoned his clerk and said, tag that Wilson and Dunn case, no default until I'm satisfied that Mr. Dunn actually received notice. And the clerk took this little yellow, they call them stick-em tab, put it on the docket sheet, and wrote, no default as per Judge White. Now, there's no question that the statement was, no, and the intent was, no default until I'm satisfied that Mr. Dunn got notice. And, of course, I think in true office shorthand, she writes, no default as per Judge White. All right. At this point, National County sends Mr. Brown, their attorney, the papers, and says, we want you to monitor, and that's the word throughout the record, monitor the file, not defend it, not file an answer. He was never authorized to file an answer. In fact, in the appendices, I think it's appendix number about 18, he's writing a letter to National County. What do you want me to do? Greenspan's going to take a default judgment on that. He's given us notice. I got the letter that he's going to take a default. Do you want me to file an answer? Of course, they never answered him. And he monitored the file. Yeah, the monitoring is, at least on two occasions, he phoned the clerk of the court and said, what's the status of the Wilson and Dunn case? And the clerk says, well, on the docket sheet, there's a little stick-em tab that says, no default as per Judge White. They said, okay. Now, this is, gentlemen, this is Prager. This is not in the record. It's clear we've got a from National County's point of view, we've got a real paradoxical situation here. Defendant has been served, and this might be this, has been served. Papers have gone to Violet Perez, his agent, and yet there can't be a default. So why file an answer? Okay. Well, obviously, it was no default until I'm satisfied that the defendant had noticed the affidavit, which I might add has it has an acknowledgement on the end. Didn't discover that until we got before the Court of Appeals. It doesn't say subscribed and sworn to. It says before me, personally appear. I did it for the purposes and considerations there and expressed. But it's still in the form of an affidavit. It is verified. And that's apparently what has happened here, is that National County was relying on that stickum on the folder and or on the docket sheet, and
plus the fact they were probably broke at the time.
Judge, they didn't say so. They were going broke, I suppose. I might add, we had a supersedious bond in this case, fortunately.
You never tried to file any amendments, any of these irregularities through the procedures of Rule 118.
You're talking about, I think 118 is amending the return.
Just return?
That's my recollection, Judge. And there was really, and I might add that none of them
may allow any process or proof of service, to be amended.
Court should be reminded the first time any of this came up was on appeal now. And in some of our other points of error, we complained about the provisions of Rule 324 not being followed, that these things were not raised on appeal. Of course, that's not within the parameters this court has directed me to stick to. But,
the whole case is here. All of them are here.
I understand. Back to these points. In appellant's, excuse me, in respondent's brief,
none of this was raised on motion for new trial.
Except they did raise that they thought the word agent, I have served Dunn's apartment manager, Harold Bellinger, agent for Dunn, or words to that effect. They thought that made it fatally defective because nobody had appointed her the agent. They dropped that on appeal.
The law heretofore in Texas has been if there is a defect apparent on its face, you don't have to file a motion for new trial. You can go straight to an appeal. But I gather what you're saying is if you do bother to go back to the trial court,
that's
then
exactly
you ought to be limited to what you've raised there, even though you don't have to go to the trial court.
Well, respectfully, I don't necessarily agree with the Chief Justice. I'm not so sure that we still have fundamental error, Judge.
Well, I'm not talking about fundamental error.
Well,
maybe
I shouldn't have used that word. I think that Rule 324, the way it's now written, and plus your Rule 81, the appellate rules, and that we probably don't have matters that are unpreserved.
Well, let me try to add it this way. You admit you can file a writ of error within 6 months after the judgment without going to the trial court.
Well, now, writ of error, of course, is restricted
to... It's a different
thing.
But if you file an appeal, which is 30 days, then you're saying you have to go to the trial court. So one should slap another name on it if you're not going to drop by the trial court.
Well, of course, they sought and received the motion for new trial. And I think they would have to, I don't see any difference in them raising the failure to verify the motion for service under 106. I think they have to raise that in the trial court, and they did. But, which to me, pours them out into Rule 324. But, like I said, that's not... We raised that issue. That issue was not written on by the Court of Appeals, and I'm not pursuing it here. I'm quite willing to, but it's not the main issue. The main issue here is, first of all, judicial admissions. The respondent said, this is tongue-in-cheek, It is, of course, of no consequence that the appellant in this case actually saw a copy of plaintiff's original petition. I might also add, in their motion for new trial, they just flat say, we acknowledge that Dunn was served citation with petition attached. It is.
We'll hear from you later. Right?
Thank you.
Court is ready to hear arguments from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Robert Fry will present arguments for respondent.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Mr. Prater. This is a fairly simple case when you get down to it as far as the law is concerned. This is a default judgment, and under the state of the law, strict compliance must be shown on the face of the record, especially when substituted service is used under Rule 106B. Now, there have been a lot of things discussed about what went on and what didn't go on. But when you look at the face of the record, Rule 106B says upon motion, upon affidavit, along with the motion, there is no affidavit that supports the motion for substituted service.
Can those defects be waived?
No, sir.
Explain that.
Okay. Going back as far as Easterline versus Bean, 1932 Supreme Court case. It was not a default judgment case. It was a case arising out of a defective probate court judgment. The Supreme Court said that you cannot ratify a null or void judgment if the court does not have jurisdiction over the person at the time that it renders the judgment, then it cannot be ratified at a later date. There are several cases, some cited in my brief and some that I will supply to the court, where evidence comes forward at the motion for new trial hearing, although that's not required. A motion for new trial is not required to preserve the defect that is fundamental, where people say, yes, we saw the suit paper. That has been held not to ratify the void judgment.
Counsel, let's assume, and I agree with you, that that is the current state of the law. As a policy matter, does that make any sense that somebody can come in and say, oh, absolutely, we knew about the suit all the time, there was a ticky defect, so we just wait a year and a half?
Yes, sir. The policy, I think, is that you're dealing with a default judgment that should be scrutinized more carefully. And I'm glad there's more default judgments being appealed. There's a reason they should be, because the defendant has not had his day in court. And if there is a defect, and if every I is not dotted, and every T is not crossed, then the plaintiff should not gain a windfall by that. And these things that come, that could be...
Counsel, but these are not the facts in this case. Your client had an opportunity to file an answer and chose not to file an answer, but just monitor the file.
Your Honor...
I mean, how... you know, getting back to Justice Phillips' question, you know, what policy reason is there for us not to carve out a narrow exception when you do judicially admit and receive service, different rules should apply?
There's a couple of responses that I could get into that. I don't think there's been a judicial admission. Dunn said that he received the suit papers. Cases cited in my brief, as a Hurd versus D.E. Goldsmith, for instance, said, yes, I received the suit papers. The Investors Diversified case, the people said, yes, we saw that we had notice of the suit. Mr. Prager talks about due process arguments and having notice, and actual notice, and the ability to file an answer and the opportunity to be heard. And those do satisfy due process requirements.
You admit you had all of that?
No, sir. I admit that Dunn found the suit papers in his apartment. I do not admit, and we have never admitted, that he was duly served.
Do you admit that you were monitoring the file and you chose not to file an answer, knowing that suit had been filed?
I admit that the record indicates, and I was not the attorney that monitored the file or was involved at the trial court level, that once due service had been accomplished, once that threshold fact had been achieved, then he was to file an answer. But, Your Honor, I think that the fundamental defect supersedes that. And the policy that you asked me about, if exceptions are carved into this, into these rules, then we are going back to a bare notice standard. Due process sets a minimum standard.
Does this comport with due process? Can't you get substituted service without an affidavit and still meet due process?
I think, Your Honor, it can satisfy due process. I do not think it can satisfy the rules of Texas Civil Procedure. Right.
But if the rule did not require an affidavit, due process would not require it.
I don't know if due process would. Before the 1981 amendment, that there are several pre-amendment cases cited in my brief, and they required either a hearing whereby you get probative evidence that this was necessary, that substituted a less desirable form of service was necessary, or it was supplied by affidavit. One of those two things had to occur, or the motion was invalid and the service was invalid.
Well, in the old Skipovitz case, didn't this court hold that as long as the facts were set out in a motion and the facts were true, it really didn't make any difference whether they were sworn or not?
Your Honor, I think that the Skipovitz case stood for the proposition that you could have a form of substituted service and satisfy due process. At that time, the form of substituted service was not as it is today. And our argument is that there is very minimum due process requirements. Texas and many other states have chosen to go rise above that because of default judgment and substituted service, and when you combine the two together, taking a default judgment on a less desirable form of service is a very harsh remedy.
But the question, my question is this a due process question or a procedural question? Because if it's due process, and this notice is not reasonably calculated to notify the defendant he's been sued, that's one thing. But if it's procedural, then what is to prevent the court from ruling that substantial compliance with the rules, rather than technical compliance, is sufficient to give notice?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the court can do that. If the court decides to do that, it will be changing the law as it is in Texas today. And you,
I think we all agree with that.
Yes, sir.
We all agree that based on the law as it now stands, you win. And the real question is, at least in my mind, I don't speak for the rest of the court, if someone is coming and says, yes, I knew about the suit papers, and they come in, why should that not constitute a waiver? Why shouldn't we say, once you, if you come in and admit yourself that you found out about it, now it's quite another thing to, if the plaintiff can only prove that you found out about it, I would not be willing to even consider going that far. I mean, we should make the plaintiff jump through all these hoops, file an affidavit that's proper, that sets out all the requirements of 106. But if the defendant comes in freely and says, yes, I knew about the suit, why should we not say that he should have answered? I mean, why should we go back and put the public to the expense of going through the whole trial process again?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the potential for abuse, in this case, there is a defendant where the real party in interest is an insurance company. I don't think that that would be the norm. I think it would be the exception. I think that there would be a lot of people that were sued by creditors, a lot of individuals that would bear the brunt of the possible abuses that would be inherent in that situation. What type of proof would be necessary if a bill collector or a creditor called the defendant and said, you know that you've been sued? I mean, where does the notice, what form of notice is required? At that point, the defendant could freely admit, yes, sir, I knew that there was a suit going on. At some point, we have to...
That's not a judicial admission, though. Telling a bill collector that.
No, sir. And I really don't think, again, I would point out that
we don't think this,
this is not a judicial admission. The one thing, it came in the motion for new trial. The depositions occurred after the judgment. Again, if he didn't, if there was no jurisdiction at that time, everything else cannot ratify. Also, the petitioner cites the Hearst versus ARA manufacturing case in his brief to stand for the proposition that because we said, admitted in our brief that he had seen the suit papers, that that is a judicial admission, and we were precluded from asserting otherwise on appeal. The Hearst case was not a defective service case. Justice Furlock wrote that in dicta. He wrote it before he even addressed what the appellant's contentions were. That case has no applicability. The only other case that is cited is the Peterson case, and that case relies solely on the Hearst case. So I think that as far as judicial admission, it is not a judicial admission, whether it comes in through evidence procured after the void judgment is taken, or whether it is mentioned in a brief, whether at the Court of Appeals level or the Supreme Court level.
Counsel, do you acknowledge also that the defendant did take the suit papers to his insurance agent?
Your Honor, that's what the deposition testimony shows.
Do you acknowledge that you've acknowledged other things here this
morning? Yes, sir. Based on that, I have no evidence to the contrary, Your Honor.
Do you think that maybe one way out of this dilemma you say we find ourselves in about creditors trying to serve debtors is to have a direct action statute where the real party of interest is an insurance company?
No, sir, I wouldn't think that's the way to solve that problem. In conclusion, I think that there are some very good policy reasons to keep the law the way it's been for 150 years.
Are they procedural policy or constitutional policy? That's my question.
They are procedural policy, Your Honor, but I think that there are very good reasons for that procedure to have evolved as it has up to the date of 1981 when the affidavit language was put into the rule. I think there are very good policy reasons for that.
I take it it's your position that even if an affidavit had been filed in support of this motion, that the return of service is still so defective that it would not support a default.
Yes, sir, under Rule 107, and based on the Hurd versus D. Goldsmith Chemical Company case, and Kirkegaard, the Kirkegaard case is also cited in my brief. The return is as fatally defective as is the motion, which was not supported by affidavit, and the order issued thereto.
If this had been discovered in the trial court, it could have all been cured by Rule 118 amendment with the trial court's lead, could it not have been?
Your Honor, are you saying it was incumbent on us to present?
No.
Okay. I do think it could have been cured. There are Rule 118 cases that go to the return of process and being able to cure that.
And to the motion.
Yes. And I would urge the court to consider the argument set forth in the return of process argument. And would also point out to the court there's been recent cases where this is not a defect that has to be presented to the trial court, either under Rule 324 of the Rules of Civil Procedure or Rule 52 under the Rules of Appellate Procedure, because it is not one of which evidence must be heard. This is a defect that must appear, or the compliance must appear on the face of the record.
And you can take that either by appeal or writ of error?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Are there any more questions? Thank you, counsel.
Counselor, you would agree that just actual notice is not enough, is it? You can't just find the fellow out walking down the street and say, incidentally, here's some suit papers, you've been sued. Don't you have to jump through some hoops to...
By all means, Judge, as a matter of fact, I'm not it's a question of whether it's a change or a clarification. I am saying that when the named defendant is served, back off here, has laid in his hands, or picked up off the floor of his apartment, or pulled it off his door, that's where it's nailed on there, or for that matter, if it's dropped from an airplane, sake of levity, and it lands in his hand, if it's never denied, but that he was served by a serving officer, regardless of who it might be, by a serving officer, with a citation from the district clerk and petition attached, and it's in his hand, regardless of how it got there, that man is served. That is all I'm asking this court to recognize.
That's a pretty big change, isn't it? I mean, we have some very stringent rules here with due process purposes behind them, whether they're required by due process or not. The purpose behind all our service rules is to make a procedure that a plaintiff has to jump through that does its best to ensure that a defendant actually gets notice. And that's why we require the affidavit of 106 that personal service has been ineffective. And what you're saying is a small change to a rule that says you can do service at any sloppy, crummy way you want to, and if it gets into the hands of the defendant and the defendant is honest enough to admit that we should then be able to proceed on.
Well, I would say, Judge, I'm not saying any sloppy way. I said you have to have a serving officer, and that answers your question as opposed to him walking down the street and somebody laying the papers in his hand.
But for instance, we don't have to have an affidavit under 106. You don't have to have prior attempts at personal service. You don't have to have service on the actual person as opposed to a wife or a girlfriend or somebody else that happens to get the papers to them. Substantial changes over the safeguards that have been built up in this state and in most states throughout the history of our jurisprudence.
Two points there, Judge Phillips. One, we do have an order that was followed religiously. And secondly,
we don't know whether it was followed religiously or not because we don't have a return that says so.
You have an admission, this has already been brought up, that he received the papers, turned them over to his insurance agent. I am saying that, first of all, I think that return is good. I'm saying that that's the only issue in this case, that return is good. We cannot expect every serving officer to follow the rigid requirement of saying served by Rule 106 and repeat the order. Now, we have mailing service by mail under the register and certified letter procedure now, and it's getting to be used more and more. I do not believe in the last year in my little office we've received more than that I've actually signed the green card for more than maybe one or two letters. I have secretaries that sign for them, and pure practicality, any office on any kind of suit.
Well, counsel, why can't we expect every serving officer to follow the rules? And in the failure of the serving officer to follow the rules, why can't we expect some kind of attention paid to it in the trial court with a motion to amend?
In the trial court, Judge, the only issue was this agent business. Dunn's agent, Carol Bellinger. Now, we probably...
You have the faulty return, though, and no attention was paid to it at that time.
I do not believe that's a faulty return. That's the reason the 118 amendment wasn't requested. Of course, it's on motion for new trial. It's the only point that's ever been raised, and I do not see anything faulty about that return. Anything faulty about that return.
Do you think your best shot is judicial admission?
No. Well, the judicial admission, they admitted on page 3 on their motion for new trial, they admitted in their appellant's brief, and they admitted it before you here today. And it just seems to me ludicrous to say, we got it, we looked back and decided, and this is really what they're saying, decided it's a little bit faulty. We're going to roll the dice, and that's what they did. Up to now, they've rolled them accurately. Now, what about the letter? I want to talk about preclusion estoppel, call it what you wish. The Mr. Greenspan was asked to agree in writing not to take a default against him. And in that letter, which is in the record, says, we acknowledge that we've now been served. We want you to agree in writing not to take a default against him. And he does. He says, you've got to give us 10 days notice before you take a default. And he did. Now,
why did you wait a year and a half?
The record shows that Mr. Greenspan attempted to settle this case. He was employed, I believe, 4.5 months after the accident. And from then until time of default, which was 2 weeks before limitations ran, that's a year, more than a year and a half, really, there's a plethora of letters, telephone calls, and Mr. Greenspan's testimony, which is the second witness in the statement of facts, shows the efforts he went through to settle it. And I think it was out of that frustration that is the reason there's not an affidavit at the end of the motion for service under 106 and a few other things that we now call oversight. But there were efforts to settle this. This man was severely hurt. The court can see the transcript, the medical reports, that he needed surgery on his neck, and he had a pre-existing neck condition. I have nothing more to add. I don't see how, under the harmless error rule, the failure to put the affidavit could in any way prejudice, this whole point, prejudice this defendant who acknowledges they got it and they intentionally, knowingly decided they were not going to file an answer. Judge Crowley's findings of fact are rather pointed in that regard. And the court should, I think, rule that certainly it's a trial court's decision, but when the trial court is satisfied that the defendant received citation and petition in a timely manner in which to get it to his attorney, or in this case, his insurance company, that they can't now come back behind that, go all the way back to the motion and say, hey, this wasn't sworn to. This I wasn't dotted. Maybe it wasn't signed. And because the practical effect for service is obviously noticed, and they got it in ample time, plus an extra 9 months because of the agreement not to take a default. Thank you.
How much money are we talking about in this case?
$475,000 was the judgment. The record shows that in the affidavit of Mr. Green that he was a courier for a courier company. He was required to carry $500,000 worth of coverage. And apparently it was not in there. The courier company had an umbrella for that. We just don't know. But anyway, the judgment was for $475,000, and I might add a modest judgment based upon today's, what you're seeing today, with considering a man that had a cervical laminectomy and a fusion, I believe it's a fusion, and then it broke loose on this record. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court will now take a brief recess.